If you've been following me for any length of time, then by now you should know how I feel about formulas. Not to overstate things, but formulas in terms of their overall impact on literature, the book industry, and storytelling as a craft and an art destroy everything. But in this video, what I want to focus on in particular is the fantasy genre. I don't know if you know this, but fantasy as a literary genre with its section in the bookstore is actually pretty new. There are some of you who probably even remember a time before the fantasy genre. Not that fantasy literature and storytelling didn't exist before, it certainly did. And I'm not just talking about mythological tales and fairy stories, but fantastical, inventive, groundbreaking, epic fantasy. But what I'm saying is that fantasy as a type of story that people tell has always existed. Fantasy as a genre at the bookstore is pretty much a modern American invention. And today, we're going to talk about how that invention, the fantasy genre at the bookstore, came to be, and why and how it destroyed fantasy literature. So let's start where all discussions of the fantasy genre start. Lord of the Rings.
He's the father of all modern fantasy. Tolkien essentially created modern fantasy.
Wrong. Tolkien didn't create anything but a world and some stories that took place in it. The fantasy genre was not only not created by Tolkien, it had nothing at all to do with Tolkien. While the modern fantasy genre as we know it was being created, Tolkien was hanging out with his buddy C.S. Lewis in England, teaching classes, raising his kids, painting, and, you know, doing Tolkien things like talking to trees or whatever. But Martin's opinion here is indicative of what is generally accepted to be true. That fantasy, as we know it today, is the product of J.R.R. Tolkien. But it's not. Have you ever stopped to wonder why we've never had another Tolkien, another Lord of the Rings, another universally captivating fantasy masterwork? It's been almost 100 years since The Lord of the Rings was initially published in England. And since that time, the fantasy genre has, for one thing, come into existence, but also has blossomed into a massive phenomenon all its own. With all the fantasy works and mega works that get published every year, why has there never been one that was so unique, so genuine, so pure in terms of creativity, that it became an overnight defining work of an entire civilization? And no, Game of Thrones does not count. One of the first biggest issues I would like to point out is that as wonderful, and I mean wonderful, as Tolkien is, he didn't do anything that unusual. His books are absolutely magical. His world building is god tier. But at a certain point, you have to take a step back and look at it. At that point, you realize that Tolkien's work, while special and beloved and perfectly crafted, is not as special as I think we've come to understand, in the sense that it was never really intended to be one of a kind. The main thing that kind of tricks us into thinking his work is so one of a kind is that there has never been anything like him since. My question is, why is that?
But that being said, Tolkien did certain things that are different than what I would do.
I don't know about you, but I find all this incredibly tedious. Oh, I'm going to be the anti-Tolkien. And then, oh, I'm going to be the anti-George R.R. Martin. I don't know, guys, maybe you could just write your damn story. The main thing to look at here is that Martin, like most or all modern fantasy writers, has defined himself in part by how different he is from what he sees as the legacy of J.R.R. Tolkien. That right there is a pretty decent encapsulation of the current fantasy publishing industry. It is a bottomless salad of tropes and formulas, and then subverted tropes and counter formulas, with nothing unique or original, or even just purely the creation of its author. But how did we get here? How did we arrive in a world where people proudly refer to Game of Thrones as the American Lord of the Rings? Something that seriously concerns me. In a way, however, I almost can't even blame Martin. After all, he is the inheritor of a genre that was killed in the crib. Fantasy, as a literary genre, never had a chance. The road that Tolkien opened up for writers and publishers with the mega popularity of The Lord of the Rings was then paved not by writers and publishers eager to explore this new literary concept, but by an opportunistic salesman who looked at The Lord of the Rings' growing popularity and saw only dollar signs. I'm talking about Lester Del Rey. This is the man who made fantasy into a serious and marketable literary genre, and who also killed fantasy before it ever even had a chance to come into its own. Let's back up a little bit to 1954, when the first volume of Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, was published in hardcover in America, followed quickly by the rest of the trilogy. I don't know if you know this, but when this happened, it was a massive cultural phenomenon. Newspapers were comparing the fanatical popularity of Tolkien's masterpiece to Beatlemania, especially on campuses where the book had become the novel of choice for youth in general, supplanting even The Catcher in the Rye. America was experiencing major cultural unrest that would change Western civilization forever. JFK had just been assassinated. America was entering the war in Vietnam. Rock music was gaining ground and evolving. Racial issues were consuming the news. Morals were shifting. The sexual revolution was shifting into high gear. The cultural landscape of America was changing seismically. Now, throw into that mess this deceptively simple and incredible book. A story that resonated with almost everyone across almost all demographics. Even if you weren't there, you can still imagine how this cosmically perfect timing resulted in something that hadn't ever happened. At least not in America, and not recently. The Lord of the Rings affected everything culturally. And by culturally, I mean mainly the arts. Elves and orcs and dark lords were suddenly everywhere. That was, in the earliest days of this phenomenon, due exclusively to the immense popularity of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Just to give you an idea of how huge this book was, imagine Harry Potter and Game of Thrones rolled into one and dominating like two entire decades. This, that is the mid-1960s, was also the time when publishing in America was drastically changing. Publishing houses had previously been companies owned by their founders or their founders' heirs, ponderously slow to change, but nevertheless bulwarks against trendsetting for the sake of trendsetting and popularity for the sake of popularity. They weren't money makers. That had never been the point of a publishing house at that time, but they could be relied upon to understand what was quality and what was a mere fad. However, this was post-industrial, post-World War II America, and at this time, the old publishing houses were being acquired by mega companies interested only in profits. Most relevant to our topic, in 1965, Random House was acquired by RCA, a conglomerate that was already establishing itself as a producer of televisions and, interestingly, defense contracts. Anyone with a little common sense can understand that starting at this point, the publishing industry by and large no longer cared about quality and never would again. A look at modern publishing will quickly reveal the ultimate embarrassing end of this crucial 1960s phase in American publishing history. Now, in 1973, when America was still locked into Frodo Lives fever, Random House, under the control of RCA, acquired Ballantine Books. At that time, the senior editor at Ballantine Books was this woman, Judy Lynn Del Rey, the fourth wife of Lester Del Rey. Now, in the future, after the establishment of the Del Rey imprint and the establishment of the Del Rey's control over speculative fiction in America, Judy Lynn Del Rey would mainly be seen as the science fiction side of things, while her husband Lester was fantasy. It's worth noting, however, that both were equally important in the destruction of American speculative fiction. Something that has always bothered me about the Del Reys and their undeniable impact on genre publishing in America is that this is almost always presented as a good thing. Judy Lynn is said to have revolutionized the fantasy genre, and Lester is even sometimes called the creator of the fantasy genre. In a sense, all of that is true, but none of it is good. Just about the only good thing Judy Lynn might have done for genre fiction was to acquire the rights for Star Wars novels before Star Wars had even been released. Nevertheless, even this good deed comes with a caveat. Having established Star Wars as the money-printing machine at Ballantine, she ensured that the science fiction genre going forward was modeled on that formula, just like Lester and Lord of the Rings. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Prior to the Judy Lynn era at Ballantine, Betty Ballantine had attempted to capitalize on the popularity of Lord of the Rings. As you probably know, when Lord of the Rings was published in America, it was Ballantine who had secured the rights to do so. So already they were printing money. But hoping to turn a single book into an industry, Betty and her husband started the adult fantasy line at Ballantine and hired Lynn Carter to be the editor. Over the next several years, they attempted to reproduce the Tolkien lightning strike by bringing other, older fantasy works of possibly equal quality into the public's view. Works such as Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast trilogy, G.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday, and Lord Dunsany's The King of Elfland's Daughter. But these efforts were largely unsuccessful. In fact, the Ballantine adult fantasy imprint had been more or less abandoned by the time Judy Lynn took over. But who were these Del Reys? Lester Del Rey, who often liked to claim that this was his full name, was born Leonard Knapp in Minnesota in 1915. He had written prolifically in sci-fi pulp magazines with a teenage target audience. In the 40s, he became an editor and continued in that work for almost 30 years. Judy Lynn had also been an editor, also for science fiction magazines, and had gradually worked her way up the ladder until Betty Ballantyne named her as her successor. Thus, in the early 1970s, when America was still in the heat of Tolkien fever, Judy Lynn Del Rey became the senior editor for Ballantyne Books. And while she worked to revitalize the publisher's science fiction line, she brought in her husband Lester to address the neglected husk that was the fantasy line. It was 1974, and things were about to change forever. That year, a manuscript made it to Judy Lynn's desk. But seeing as it was fantasy and not her usual science fiction, she gave it to her husband Lester. This manuscript, Terry Brooks, The Sword of Shannara. Anyone who's even loosely familiar with this book knows that it's pretty much a straight imitation of Tolkien. Most publishers decried such a shamelessly derivative work, but not Lester. When he read The Sword of Shannara, he recognized it for what it really was, minor details aside. A relatively well-told Tolkien ripoff. And unlike his more traditional-minded competitors in the industry, he didn't see a shameless knockoff. He saw dollar signs. The manuscript needed a lot of work, and among the many things Lester insisted that Brooks alter was any hint at the possibility of a science fiction element. As the story was meant to take place in the distant future of Earth after a nuclear apocalypse had decimated and then altered civilization, which, by the way, probably would have made The Sword of Shannara more of its own unique original work and less of an imitation. But no, said Lester. Science fiction and fantasy must never mix. Never. The Del Reys intended to use this book and the subsequent franchise as the launching point for both their imprint, Del Rey Books, and their entire philosophy. Colleagues of the Del Reys stated that Brooks' Shannara book was like their baby, and Lester knew exactly what he was doing. Capitalizing on the overt Tolkien imitation, instead of advising Brooks to tone it down, Lester decided to lean into it. He even went as far as hiring the brothers Hildebrandt, who had done numerous iconic illustrations for The Lord of the Rings, to do the cover art for The Sword of Shannara. And the Del Rey's investment paid off. The Sword of Shannara was a major commercial success. It is generally regarded as the book that ushered in the modern age of commercially lucrative fantasy fiction. But Lester was a savvy businessman. He couldn't just sit back and hope that a whole host of new writers would just deliver countless manuscripts to him that would meet the same exacting parameters established and tested by Terry Brooks' The Sword of Shannara. So he decided to be proactive. It was then that Lester Del Rey put together his own formula. This was the mandatory shape all fantasy books submitted to Del Rey must take. The books would be original novels set in invented worlds in which magic works. Each would have a male central character who triumphed over the forces of evil, usually associated with technical knowledge of some variety, by innate virtue, and with the help of a tutor or tutelary spirit. Other sources include added parameters such as the detail that the male lead character must always get the girl, but I had trouble verifying those sources completely. I've always wondered if this was what Lester Del Rey really believed was the core of Tolkien's work and therefore the reason for its success, this two-sentence, hyper-specific formula, or if he simply pared down the simplest and most recognizable elements of Lord of the Rings and derived a straightforward formula within which he would still have a bit of room for variety. I doubt we'll ever know. I personally looked everywhere for interviews with the Del Reys having more to do with their publishing than with their own writing, and the only one I managed to find was this one, in which the interviewer actually did attempt to get the Del Reys to pin down what, in their minds, constituted a good fantasy book. This was almost impossible to read. The answers were vague, meandering, or just incomprehensible. As for what made a good book good, it seemed ultimately to come down to it having a plot, or it being entertaining, but which, nevertheless, must still remain within his strict, arbitrary, formulaic boundaries. When the interviewer tried to get the Del Reys to explain why those boundaries made a book good, the bizarre, incomprehensible answers always came down to, it's what will sell. However, their understanding of why things that sell, sell, was inaccurate and incomplete. It goes without saying that even that was subject to their own completely subjective view. All talk about this bizarrely specific formula aside, it did, like it or not, prove to be successful. For a time. Now, remember, the creation of Del Rey Books, the publication of The Sword of Shannara, and the birth of Lester Del Rey's formula all also coincided with the emergence of two other brand new publishing phenomena, the major chain bookstore and mass market paperbacks. Lester's business model was simple. Accessible fantasy books that scratched the Tolkien itch for the survivors of the Tolkien fever at a cheap price in shops that were everywhere. The brand new shopping mall typically came complete with a B. Dalton or a Walden Books, and Lester wanted to put his $3 fantasy paperbacks in each and every one of them. And so he did, to great success. You can probably guess what happened next. All the other publishers looked at Del Rey Books, making all kinds of money with their paperback fantasy books, all of which fit into Lester's strict formula, and they started to do the exact same thing. Several other publishers opened fantasy lines and started churning out paperbacks published according to the same winning formula. In 1980, Tom Doherty founded Tor Books, and for quite some time paid strict attention to Lester's model. Even a decade later, in 1990, when they published Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, this formula was forefront in their mind. As editor Patrick Nielsen Hayden said, "We looked at how Del Rey made Terry Brooks, and we did that." I don't particularly feel like debating whether or not some or all of these books have any value. Lester Del Rey didn't really view fantasy literature in that way. He regarded fantasy and science fiction as having a built-in limited shelf life. His aim was to capitalize on his era's tastes and cultural demands in order to make a profit. A side benefit was the people's entertainment. Whether or not entertainment is a good enough literary motivator all by itself is not the topic of this video. The main point I want to make here is that Lester Del Rey was explicitly uninterested in making anything that had any cultural staying power or value beyond its $3 price tag. He didn't see this as a worthwhile pursuit and was openly critical of anyone who sought to champion this type of writing. A book, to him, was a commodity, a product, like a bar of soap, intended to be written, published, purchased, read, and then forgotten. Lester Del Rey, the man who, we can all agree, built and shaped the modern fantasy publishing genre, did not believe that fantasy was anything more than a product, and the entire industry followed suit. This philosophy of his was very pleasing to the new corporate overlords of the publishing world, mega companies that believed nothing was more important than the bottom line. This philosophy was consistent with the ethos of a world that was newly emerging in the 1970s and 80s, a world of shopping malls and chain stores and mass-produced everything. It was like the universe aligned and cleared the path for the Del Reys to build the fantasy genre we would all be forced to inherit. Even though the initial formula proved relatively successful, it only served to produce, or mass produce, a product that would only sell as long as the demand existed. Putting aside the monstrous crime against literature writ large that the Del Reys perpetrated with their hugely lucrative and hugely influential philosophy, this simply can't work forever. David G. Hartwell, writing in the New York Times in 1990, had this to say about the result of the Del Rey's control over genre fiction as manifest already in his own times. In 1990, we as readers are the inheritors of this phenomenon. Unquestionably, it created an enormous wave of trash writing to fill the neurotic hungers of an established audience, trained in the 70s and in the past decade to accept tiny nuances and gestures overlaying mediocrity and repetition as true originality. The 60s begat the 70s, the 70s begat the 1980s, and anyone who experienced the late 70s and 80s knows all too well just how gluttonously weird and debauched that time was. The 1990s brought about a cultural counter-revolution across the board, and that included fantasy literature. Just as the Western world sloughed off the over-the-top glitz of 80s rock and replaced it with 90s grunge, it was also time to slough off the tired, stale Del Rey formula. This, then, a literary world saturated with Del Rey's factory-produced Tolkien knockoffs and those paperbacks mass-produced by Del Rey's imitators, was the world in which the second actor in our drama opened his eyes. Enter Michael Moorcock. I want to mention, there were a lot of writers who came to react negatively to the proliferation of the Del Rey's philosophy. The main reason I've singled out Michael Moorcock is because he is often styled the anti-Tolkien, and he was particularly vociferous about his dislike of what he deemed Tolkien-esque speculative fiction. He was also very influential. Many other writers took their cues from him. Now, This video is not concerned with Moorcock's work as a writer, but rather with his more influential role as an editor and generally a tastemaker in the world of speculative fiction. In 1964, Moorcock became the editor of New Worlds, where he would remain, besides a brief 5-year absence from 71 to 76, until 1996. It was here, within the pages of New Worlds, that Moorcock would champion what he deemed a counterculture revolution against this world that had been, by and large, created by the Del Reys. His very first essay for New Worlds, published in 1964 when he took over, heavily suggested that he intended to bring a new flavor to science fiction. Interesting as that may be, it doesn't really have anything to do with our topic. It wasn't until Moorcock published his essay Epic Pooh that he really made clear his thoughts on the publishing industry of his time. Now, there are a lot of people out there who have thoroughly addressed just how wildly nonsensical Moorcock's poorly written takedown of Tolkien really is, so much so, in my opinion, that I found myself wondering if the man had actually read Tolkien. But what struck me as particularly notable was that Moorcock, like George R.R. Martin, like so many other critics of fantasy literature at that time, assumed that this, which he loathed with every fiber of his being, was due solely to the influence of Lord of the Rings, as if Tolkien had personally, with his own hands, formed 1960s and 70s fantasy literature. And as I think I've made abundantly clear, Tolkien actually had nothing to do with it. The world of Western fantasy against which Moorcock railed so violently was not ruled by the influence of Tolkien, but by the influence of Lester Del Rey. Now, defending Tolkien's honor isn't really the purpose of this video, but I think it is worth mentioning that among many other tragedies caused by Lester Del Rey's Tolkien imitation formula and its insane, monstrous success, was that it made Tolkien the bad guy, the imaginary villain in some cultural war within Western publishing that simply never took place. Most of the critical examinations of modern Western fantasy publishing that I've come across name Tolkien as the primary villain in the production of this vast world of samey, boring, formulaic, overly simplistic, mass-produced slop. And that's just, you know, not true. Of course, they use other words too, like chauvinistic, sexist, and so on. I mean, please allow me to redirect your attention to Lester Del Rey's formula. But because Moorcock assumed this world was due to the influence of Tolkien, he manufactured, either deliberately or as a powerful influence, a childishly contrarian counterculture, which was ultimately little more than a direct and deliberate mirror opposite, not of Tolkien, but of Lester Del Rey. Moorcock looked at the world of Del Rey and his imitators and blamed Tolkien. Most who had grown tired of the inane formulaic output of these now established fantasy lines also blamed Tolkien. The formula had grown stale, as all formulas inevitably will, and so counter-formulas emerged, creating a trend all their own. As is always the case when a formulaic endeavor becomes tired and stagnant, the counter-response to it is almost always its mirror opposite. That is to say, just another formula. And a formula that is nothing more than, as I said, mere contrarianism. This formula was pretty easy. Everything Del Rey said, but do the opposite. Del Rey says Tolkien thought industrialism was bad, so we're going to have lots of industrialism in our books. Del Rey said Tolkien's heroes were all noble and virtuous. No, they weren't. So our characters are going to be drug addicts, selfish, degenerate, incestuous villains, and so on. Del Rey says that in Tolkien, evil is always destroyed. And in Del Rey's books, the hero always wins. Therefore, in our books, the hero doesn't win. Or if he does, it's because he became bad, or whatever. Tolkien and Del Rey didn't put sex in their books. You guessed it, there's gonna be so much sex in our books. It's so obvious that it actually got to the point, at least with Martin, that I just had to ask myself, if Del Rey had published this book, what would happen next? And whatever the opposite of that was, that's what happened next. At the end of the day, it was just another formula. Moorcock and Martin's complaints about his era's fantasy literature initially feel like they are anti-Tolkien, as many of the elements of Del Rey's formula were plucked directly from Lord of the Rings. But in reality, these writers waging their important and noble crusade against Tolkien are rebelling against nothing more significant than some random salesman's relatively successful product model. That's it. Moreover, like most people who let out this huge, energetic, knee-jerk, reactionary complaint about whatever is most firmly established, such as Moorcock rebelling against established fantasy publishing, at first it comes across like innovative, unique creativity. But then, after you think about it for longer than 5 minutes, you realize that most of these people are simply memorizing everything Lester Del Rey said, and then they're saying the opposite. That's not unique thought, it's just another formula. Even now, many are becoming fatigued by this new Game of Thrones era of bleak, ultra-grim fantasy, and they are responding with a new cycle of subversion and contrarianism. As is the case with Catherine Addison and her horrible, horrible The Goblin Emperor, which she herself admits was at least in part a counter-response to Game of Thrones.
It is a book that was quite deliberately trying to do several things that fantasy right now has not been doing, because so much of fantasy right now has been so influenced by George R.R. Martin. But it does mean that things have been very grim and bleak and pessimistic and cynical. So it is deliberately, it's not a utopia, but it is utopianist in that it is arguing that doing the right thing will win. That if you try your best to be ethical and compassionate, you will come out on top.
So, as the established fantasy genre evolved, one formula begat a predictable counterformula, which begat a predictable counterformula, and so on forever, leading us now, in current year, to peruse the shelves of our local Barnes & Noble and think, golly, this sure is pretty far removed from that, must be new and unique. Is it, though? Is Game of Thrones progressive and intelligent just because it's so different from the Sword of Shannara? Does that really make one good and one bad? For that matter, how far removed, really, is this from this? I mean, really. Let's take a step back and look at what we have. The beginning of fantasy as a genre, as introduced to the reading public by Tolkien's Lord of the Rings phenomenon, was hijacked by an opportunistic editor in post-industrialist America whose one goal was to produce a successful product model. For at least two decades, that dominated the fantasy genre. The fantasy genre entered American consciousness, probably Western consciousness, in this form. When the time came for it to become tired and loathsome, Moorcock and his ilk countered with an equally tired and equally loathsome formula. Fantasy, as we have it now, is little more than the continued response to Del Rey's initial output. Like rebellious sons anchored by the paltry inheritance left them by their reckless father, modern fantasy authors such as Martin and his imitators, who wish to maintain relevance within this genre, still subsist on this imagined crusade against some broad, hazy publishing philosophy that they believe dominated their industry immediately after Tolkien, little realizing that they are fighting no greater enemy than basic corporate greed, and that they are doing so in service of still more basic corporate greed. But at the end of the day, no matter what form the newest formula takes, the big corporate overlords just look around and see which one is probably going to generate the most revenue, and then they issue their decrees. Thus, when the anti-Tolkien Game of Thrones became the flavor of the decade, just as Del Rey's boring fantasy had been the flavor of the 60s and 70s, the machine that Lester Del Rey created that would mass-produce paperbacks based on derivations of whatever trend was popular at the time, calculated a few variations on the Game of Thrones formula, and put it to work. Lester Del Rey's formula engine is still going strong, even though his original formula has been largely abandoned. This engine is, in fact, the power source for the Western fantasy genre. Lester Del Rey's fantasy formula experiment was proof of concept to the entire newborn publishing industry of the 60s and 70s. They looked at him and how he did things, and that was how they built the foundation of modern publishing. All modern publishing. Now, something you might ask, and it's not an unfair question, is what does it matter? So what if Del Rey Books and thereafter all book publishing use a series of formulas to create an endless supply of arguably entertaining books? It only matters that they're entertaining, right? Who cares if they're not mega epics like Lord of the Rings? First of all, as I've said before, aside from how incredibly well-crafted it is in itself, one very big reason we think of Tolkien's work as so extraordinary is because after it appeared, there was never again anything like it or even on its level. The literary world has taken this to mean that Tolkien was therefore some kind of writing god, the likes of whom the world will never see again, but that's not true. I do understand the original point, though, that it doesn't matter if it's all formulaic as long as it's entertaining, but I have two major issues with that. One is that entertaining is inherently subjective. What's entertaining to one person might be dull as powder to another. So from a strictly business perspective, the model is flawed. Second, and I believe this is the larger issue and the one that's harder to drive at directly, entertainment for the sake of entertainment can be fun, but it's a lot like convenience store pastries. Twinkies are great, but that can't be the only thing you eat. If it is, you'll die. That doesn't mean that you have to eat only dry wheat bread and unsalted carrot mash for the rest of your life. Ideally, your healthy food is also delicious. Similarly, the goal of every writer who wants to write something that's a bit more than a two-week bestseller that's forgotten forever before the end of the month is write something that is both beautiful and important and that entertains. I have no intention of sitting here and defining what it is that makes a book beautiful and important, but I can tell you 100% such a book simply will not ever be published by the formula-driven fantasy machine created by Lester Del Rey. Entertainment, and by that I mean the arts, is a crucially important aspect of the human condition, kind of like food. Just as mass-produced food makes people unhealthy, the same goes for mass-produced entertainment. We've entered an era when all Western entertainment is corporate formula slop. Yes, all of it. So, if even our fantasy literature can only be more mass-produced entertainment for the sake of entertainment, at some point we're going to reach a kind of Twinkie entertainment critical mass as a civilization, if we haven't already. Now, don't get me wrong. I think stories absolutely must be entertaining. I think it is a storyteller's obligation to entertain their audience. However, if entertainment is the publisher's only aim, then I think they've missed the point by a country mile. Also, I think allowing a bunch of corporate overlords to decide how it is that we are entertained is troubling. Additionally, there is a difference between following popular trends and adhering to an industry formula. One is organic and follows its own natural path and life cycle. The other is corporate and profit-driven. And the thing is, because that machine and that business model exists as the foundation of Western publishing, it's basically impossible for anything other than Twinkies to ever be published. And in the rare case that such a book is published, it's an absolutely Herculean task. Is it possible to save Western fantasy publishing? I don't know. Listen, nothing is stopping you from writing a great fantasy novel. Nothing is stopping you from ignoring what is or isn't part of the formula and just writing what you want to write. Whether or not you'll be able to publish it is another matter. But the fantasy publishing world, such as it is the world that Lester Del Rey built, and it's the one we live in. Maybe we can fight the giant corporate monster and its formula engine. Maybe we can't. Maybe knowledge like this will lead some writers to despair and put down their pens forever. Maybe this knowledge is driving force enough to make that one person out there write the masterpiece that ends up on the shelf next to Lord of the Rings. Who knows? It certainly isn't going to stop me from writing. If you're a reader, maybe now is the time to expand your horizons a little. Fantasy literature had unimaginable breadth before Lester Del Rey got his hands on it. Start exploring a little. What you find might be your next favorite book. Who knows? If you're a writer, whatever the industry is doing, do yourself a favor and ignore it. Don't do the opposite. Don't try to subvert it. Just ignore it, like it isn't even there. To hell with the formulas and the corporate decrees. To hell with what's popular on Twitter or book talk or whatever. Learn to write well, to build solid structure based on principles, not formulas. Constantly improve your craft and study the greats. And whatever you do, don't stop telling stories. As always, thank you very much for watching.